Nuclear misdirection. Magicians do their tricks by directing your mind and your eye to follow false clues, misdirections, that result in them fooling you in a way that is both a surprise and a delight. But nuclear misdirections don't surprise or delight anyone, except maybe the nukesters. Their planned deceptions, such as the "don't look at hundreds of thousands of years of DNA-damaging, health-threatening, high-level radioactive waste produced by our energy system. Look at the 1 nanosecond in the reactor when it doesn't produce carbon. Hurrah! That makes us green!" It's deceptions like that that are intended to lull the public and the government that are supposed to protect them into a stupor of approval. Don't look at the real story over there. Just look at the one tiny piece we are pointing to where we come off okay, and just ignore the rest. It's not important. The nuclear industry does it all the time, but never as blatantly as at Fukushima in Japan, especially as regards the ongoing release of 1.3 million tons of radioactive tritium-contaminated wastewater that are now flowing into the Pacific Ocean. Japan and Tokyo Electric Power Company, the two in charge, say that their actions are perfectly safe. And look, they're even testing the water, the sand. And there's the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, right there, saying, "We tested it too, and everything is just hunky-dory, peachy-keen, A-OK, and nothing to see here, folks, move along." And we do. Even the journalists. But then you talk with a genuine expert on radiation in the marine environment, and you ask him what, if anything, is being done that might be considered wrong about that oh-so-reassuring IAEA-approved testing. And he tells you,
"All the coastal populations along that stretch of coast to the south of Fukushima are going to have that Oyoshio current laden with Fukushima radioactivity drifting past their beaches and their coastlines, and there will be fishermen down there who will be working. So it's important to monitor at distance, as well as to monitor for sea to land transfer, as well as to monitor fine sediments in estuaries and on the seabed."
And that's not the half of it. Well, when acclaimed marine biologist Tim Deer Jones points out Japan's, TEPCO's, and the IAEA's testing flaws and blind spots that are so blatant they can be recognized and called out from half a world away, but nobody else seems to be challenging these manufactured assurances, you can be certain that what we're seeing here is a major outpost of that scary, awful, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, there is strong scientific pushback to the theater of testing taking place on Japan's radioactive tritium-contaminated wastewater release from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean. We talk with Tim Deer Jones, a UK-based marine biologist who specializes in radiation issues in bodies of water from rivers and bays to oceans. We also talk with Tanya Moss, director of the Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio, which holds the largest archive of materials in the U.S. relating to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings and Hibakusha issues. It's second in size only to the Hiroshima Peace Institute in Japan. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than will show up in the results of any of today's U.S. regional elections. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 7, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off in Japan, where that country began releasing its third batch of radioactive tritium-contaminated water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant on Thursday, November 2nd. Tokyo Electric Power Company said that after finishing inspections following its second release, it had found no reason to alter procedures. As for that testing, the results of which have gotten a thumbs up from the International Atomic Energy Agency, we will have much more about what is not being done in the testing and what is being done in a way that provides misdirection. That will be in today's featured interview with Tim Deere Jones. The Group of Seven, or G7 industrial powers, last Sunday, November 5th, called for the immediate repeal of import curbs on Japanese food products, a reference to China's restrictions after Japan began releasing the radioactive wastewater from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean. The G7 trade ministers also denounced what they consider its rising economic coercion through trade. But while they've gone after China, they have not gone after Russia, which announced similar restrictions earlier this month. A reminder that even as China and Russia are holding to a 100% ban on all Japanese seafood items, the United States is stepping into the breach and lapping it up, first by purchasing scallops from Japan to feed to the U.S. military personnel in Japan and be sold in shops and restaurants on military bases there. U.S. Ambassador to Japan Rahm Emanuel said, "It's going to be a long-term contract between the U.S. Armed Forces and the fisheries and co-ops here, with the stated goal being to kind of wear out China's economic coercion." Right. Condemnation of the radioactive toxic water discharge continues to come from abroad, specifically now in Seoul, South Korea, where civic groups and experts called for an immediate halt to the discharge and the establishment of an international monitoring mechanism that will be effective over the long term. Dozens of Japanese citizens from multiple civic groups attended a rally in Tokyo on Wednesday, November 1st, demanding that Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, the operator of the crippled Fukushima facility, immediately halt the ocean discharge. As one 72-year-old resident of Chiba Prefecture said, "We are all saying, stop it, stop it. But I think the voices of those who are saying stop need to get louder." And this interesting talking point emerged from communications received from the Korea Center for Sustainable Development. They wrote, "This issue has been framed as a global political hegemonic conflict between the USA and China by Japan and the United States, not as what it is, a universal environmental and health issue." We will be talking with a representative of the Korea Center for Sustainable Development for a program later this month. In international news, on October 16, we have learned NATO began its annual nuclear attack rehearsal dubbed Steadfast Noon. This practice involves air forces from 13 countries, the exercising of fighter jets and US B-52s, and these exercises lasted until October 26, almost two full weeks, with the planes roaring over Italy, Croatia, and Eastern Mediterranean, not far from two aircraft carrier battle groups charging towards the war over Gaza Strip. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said, "Our exercise will help to ensure the credibility, effectiveness, and security of our nuclear deterrent." In other words, to quote longtime journalist and activist of Nuke Watch, "This is shrewd silk tie talk about threatening nuclear attacks, threats barely distinguishable from Putin's verbal warnings." Steadfast Noon is a role play for pilots, a dry run to test classroom preparations made at the German branch of the U.S. Air Force Nuclear College on Ramstein Air Base. According to the school's website, it is responsible for delivering, sustaining, and supporting air-delivered nuclear weapon system for our warfighters every day. This article by LaForge, which we will link to, also quotes Daniel Ellsberg, who wrote in Things That Can and Cannot Be Said, "Our private top-secret estimates were that we would kill every European, 100 million Europeans, without a single U.S. or Soviet warhead landing on West Europe, just from the fallout of the attacks we were planning on Russia and East Europe. 100 million. In Russia, it's now official. President Vladimir Putin has revoked the country's ratification of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, a move he says is designed to bring Moscow in line with the United States. The 1996 treaty outlaws all nuclear explosions, including live tests of nuclear weapons, though it was never effective because some key countries did not ratify it, including the United States. Meanwhile, a piece of good news. On November 3rd, the United Nations General Assembly's first committee, which deals with disarmament and international security, those diplomats considered for the first time a resolution entitled "Addressing the Legacy of Nuclear Weapons, Providing Victim Assistance and Environmental Remediation to Member States Affected by the Use or Testing of Nuclear Weapons." Two of the countries affected by nuclear weapons testing, the republics of Kazakhstan and Kiribati, which were influenced by Soviet Union and UK-US tests, brought the resolution forward and advocated broadly for its adoption. It was a massive victory to have 171 countries vote to support this resolution, with only 4 no votes and 6 abstentions. And a major political and diplomatic oops in Israel, as a junior far-right minister in the Israeli government suggested that it would be an option for Israel to use a nuclear weapon in Gaza. He was immediately suspended indefinitely from his post, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Heritage Minister Amichai Eliyahu's comments were, quote, not based in reality. Israel has a longstanding tradition of never commenting on whether or not it has nuclear weapons, though it is generally recognized as one of the 9 countries that does have the bomb. More woes for the U.S. Department of Energy's poster child for new small modular nuclear reactors, NuScale Corporation. As we have reported here in previous weeks, NuScale cut a deal for 24 units of its latest but still uncertified small modular nuclear reactor design by Standard Power, which has been denounced as a phony client and denounced as having zero chance of this contract being executed. Now, Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff are questioning the ability of the reactor building to withstand aircraft impacts as NuScale changed the design from reinforced concrete to steel concrete composite without providing a revised safety analysis. And radiation monitors under the BioShield are only qualified for 2 days after a core meltdown when they are supposed to be available for at least 100 days. Hearings are scheduled to start tomorrow. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
The Pentagon has announced that a new nuclear bomb 24 times more powerful than either of the ones dropped on Japan is on their wish list, and they are going full steam ahead in seeking congressional approval and, of course, funding to create a new and improved B-61-13 nuclear gravity bomb to replace the still in production and not yet available for use, but they're planning on it with all the pits from Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory, B-61-12. According to Pentagon press materials, the B-61-13 will, quote, provide us with additional flexibility by providing the president with additional options against certain harder and larger area military targets. If that's not military nuke speak for Russia, I don't know what is. According to some insiders, the decision to build the B-61-13 appears to have less to do with a military need than striking a political deal to get rid of the last megaton yield weapon in the U.S. arsenal. The big, big bomb versus the biggest big bomb debate has become a focal point in the battle between the Biden administration, which wants to retire it, and congressional hardliners who want to keep it. Because let's face it, we have to make certain that our bang is bigger than their bang. Meanwhile, billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayers are being thrown at these monstrosities, with no input from the American public saying, you know, there might be a better way to spend this money, like on health care and schools and infrastructure. Silly me. We all know where these military guys have their heads fixed. And they don't want to hear about no stinking small bombs. They want annihilation and nothing less. 24 times Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hey, let's make it even bigger than that, which I'm sure they would if they could. And that's why Pentagon and all the nukesters who are behind this new nuclear bomb nonsense, you are all this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
To get a really clear idea of the kind of damage that would be inflicted if this new B-61-13 bomb were used, even once, it's time to visit NukeMap by Alex Wallerstein. NukeMap is an interactive website that generates the numbers, the magnitude of death, injury, and physical damage caused by use of any of the known existing nuclear weapons to any place on Earth. Pick a bomb, pick a location, click a few buttons, and then click detonate. Lots of fun at parties. We'll have a link up to NukeMap along with simple instructions on how to use it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 646. Then, I suggest you take a look at Greg Mitchell's award-winning film, Atomic Cover-Up. It shows the first film footage taken on the ground at Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the use of the bombs, much of which was classified as top secret and suppressed for decades. Then think. This new bomb is touted as being 24 times more powerful than the ones used to create what you're looking at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Are we really that insane? By what stretch of the imagination or dementia could anyone think that nuclear weapons are a good idea? If you want a reality check, this is how you get it. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, now here's this week's featured interview. Japan has started its projected 30-year process of discharging radioactive tritium-contaminated wastewater from Fukushima and its triple meltdown into the Pacific Ocean. While the water has been treated by the Advanced Liquid Processing System, referred to as ALPS, it cannot remove tritium, which has a radioactive half-life of about 12 years and will be radioactively damaging for 10 half-life cycles, or 120 years. The nuclear industry likes to pretend that tritium is, meh, no big deal, but it's radioactive. It accumulates in the body, and it does great harm to our health and lifespans, and will for more than another 100 years. But the experts, the nuclear experts, advocating for the system of disposal into the Pacific and signing off on its safety, is the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA. What's wrong with that picture? This UN-based agency has in its charter a mandate to support nuclear energy and reactors. As for the standards of what constitutes safety, these levels have been set by the IAEA. Box guarding the hen house much? And now, the IAEA is doing what they call testing of the released radioactive water into the Pacific and declaring it as safe. They even released a short promo video with catchy background music touting their achievements. Well, here at Nuclear Hot Seat, we're a bit more skeptical and decided to consult our own genuine experts to get their take on this radioactive water release. To do so, we contacted Tim Deer Jones. He is a UK-based marine biologist, researcher, and consultant who specializes in analysis of the radiation threats to our planet's waters from a wide range of nuclear sources. We've already covered the meaning of Alps, so two more points for clarity. When Tim talks about testing estuaries, a word I had to look up to make certain I had it right, he's referring to an arm of the sea that extends inland to meet the mouth of a river. And Honshu is the central and largest of the four main islands of Japan. It is regarded as the Japanese mainland and the island where the Fukushima disaster happened. I spoke with Tim Dear Jones on October 25th, 2023. Tim Dear Jones, always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Great to be with you, Libby.
Japan has continued with its release of the radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima Daiichi, recently dumping their second batch into the Pacific Ocean. The International Atomic Energy Agency, which gave a thumbs up to this process, has been on site saying that they're doing all kinds of testing. And they even released a video showing and promoting, very PR, very slick, very well done, but promoting their perspective on the work they're doing. And it looks very impressive and very important. First of all, have you seen the video of what the IAEA purports to be doing? And what are your perceptions about it?
Yeah, I've seen it, and it's my perceptions are that it's an extremely shallow piece of work. Doesn't really go into much in the way of detail, but what you can see, it's quite evident that they're not really pulling all the stops out. They say they are doing seawater sampling. Well, okay, so seawater is the very basic, and that's where you would expect to find the lowest levels of radioactivity, because, of course, in the seawater, you haven't got anything like biomagnification or enrichment taking place. So that doesn't tell you that much that you need to know really about what's happening to the marine environment. Secondly, they're doing fish. They showed what appeared to be flat fish. Okay, so those are demersals. They tend to live closer to the seabed, but a lot of them are not necessarily sort of native to the area. They could be migratory. They could be coming in and out on a seasonal basis. So we don't really think that they're necessarily very representative either. And if that's where they're stopping in terms of looking at the animal life, they're not looking up the food chain at the top predators who would be accumulating and bioaccumulating much, much higher levels than you would expect to see in the fish. So that's a bit of a con, really. And then I noticed that they have claimed very loudly that they're doing marine sediments, but the video itself shows them on a sandy beach taking samples of sand. And my own work has demonstrated quite clearly that sand has larger particle grains than, say, sediments that you might find in an estuary or on a muddy seabed. And the large particles have much lower radioactivity than the fine particles, consistently show throughout any monitoring studies that you look at. So by and large, they're not showing us the serious top-end picture of the most magnified effects that you might expect to find in the marine environment. So I think it's a bit of a con, really. And looking at that work as shown in the video, and also thinking about what they have been doing consistently throughout the Daiichi episode and the discharges of radioactivity to water, deliberate discharges, and also the post-accidental unintentional discharges into the water, they're just really fudging the issue. They're not looking at the alpha emitters. We know that there was plutonium and americium and a range of other alpha emitters coming out of that reactor that would be in the groundwater. I would expect that to have been in all of the stored water that was treated by ALPS. You can't extract alpha radioactivity from your water except by using very, very complicated and expensive processes. And there's no suggestion but the ALPS treatment process that they were using on that stored water would remove significant amounts of alpha. And I noticed that all the way through since the original accident, they haven't really been focusing very much on the alpha emitters, like the plutonium and the americium, which of course are those which have the most serious potential radiological impact on human health if they get inside the human body. So that's one failure. I noticed that they're not monitoring for organically bound tritium, which is the much more serious version of tritium in terms of biological impact. It's something which has a longer half-life than ordinary tritium. It's something that delivers a longer dose because it's within the animal and indeed the mammalian system for a longer period of time. And tritium is important because both as tritiated water and as organically bound tritium, it has an effect on all sorts of human and mammalian systems, including the RNA. The whole thing is just a fudge, really, and it's designed to impress the public with, oh, look what a lot of busy technical work we're doing, but actually not to give you the most serious implication results that you might find if you were to carry out the kind of work that I've been implying. And then it's all being done to, as they say, the best international safety standards. But those international safety standards have been actually constructed and issued to the global public and the global nuclear industry by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And we mustn't forget that the IAEA is there to help the propagation, evolution, and development and expansion of the civil nuclear industry. So it's kind of what we in UK would call gamekeepers, poachers being turned into gamekeepers. So the people who are producing the pollutants and supporting the other people who are producing the pollutants are also the people who are allowed to oversee and design all the safety standards and oversee the monitoring. So from my end of looking at it, and many of my colleagues in the radiation campaign area, we don't think that this is up to much, really, and it's a bit of a con, and it's designed to pull a fast one over on the public.
From my admittedly limited but persistent over 12 and a half years view of Fukushima Daiichi and the nuclear industry, a few of the issues that come forward for me as areas where they fudge is they do not reveal the depth of the water from which they took the samples. And I know that the radionuclides are heavy metals. They tend to filter down into the sediment. So if they're taking water samples, how deep was the water? How far away was it from the point of discharge? And in what direction tidally has that discharge been going? And when it comes to testing the fish, how long does it take before fish of the kind that they are testing, there are six different varieties, how long does it take after they have been exposed to or ingested radioactivity, does it take before it shows up in the body? Or is this too short a time for anything to be showing up?
Yeah, these are all very relevant points, Levy. And I think you're quite right in all the issues you raise there. And to date, we haven't been given that information in any detailed way. So the IAEA and TEPCO are really treating the rest of us, the citizens of the immediate area and the citizens of the greater area, i.e. the Pacific Ocean, as if we were kids, children, who aren't really capable of coping with any sort of serious data. And all that is required for us is reassuring noises and pictures of people with masks and bits of technical equipment yomping about on beaches and pulling things out of the water. You can't tell, you know, until we actually get told in detail what species of fish they are, where they were caught, and at what distance, north, south, up tide, down tide, from the discharge point those samples were taken, it's all pretty meaningless, really. And I hope that people in Japan will be able to pressurize TEPCO and the Japanese nuclear regulators to get on with the job, treat us as if we are serious, intelligent citizens, and give us the full data so that we can actually make up our own minds about what we're seeing and what we're being told. Because at the moment, we are just being fobbed off with sort of superficial pictures and sleight of hand information, really.
Is there a better way in existence for monitoring this discharge? I know we should just cut to the chase and not have these discharges at all, but considering that they have happened twice already and it's planned that they will be ongoing over the next 30 years, is there a better way in existence to monitor them?
Well, I'll just start off by saying, for the next 30 years, does this mean that the Japanese authorities think that the groundwater will suddenly and miraculously stop running through the wrecked Fukushima site after 30 years? Or are they actually talking about the time it will take them to discharge the radioactive water that they have on site? I rather think it's the latter, because I can't see an end to the natural groundwater running through the wrecked Daiichi site in 30 years, because as far as I can see, that's going to carry on as long as groundwater is running off the high ground inland. So that's a bit of a con for a start. What are they going to do when they've got rid of this water that they have stored? And are they capturing more water as they are discharging this stuff now? So that's one point, which I think is, again, is another con trick that we're being handed out. Now, as far as actually doing the monitoring and the analysis, it's quite evident that if you look at the independent peer-reviewed science which gets published in academic journals, there are contradictions between that kind of work and what the nuclear industry likes to do. So I would say that there are a number of issues which need to be analysed and monitored on a fairly strict basis and quite continuously. Previous listeners to me talking to you on your show will be aware of the fact that I'm very concerned about sea to land transfer, which happens when waves break along a shoreline and the bubbles from the bursting waves get blown ashore by onshore winds. Now, here in the UK, we've had work done which has demonstrated that that can drive radioactivity at least 10 miles inland, and there's good reason to believe that sea salt will blow inland from the coast as a result of bubbles breaking in breaking waves, and that that can occur for at least 50 miles inland. In the Gulf states of the southern US, there's a bacteria called Intracellulare maritima, which causes a lung infection called Batty's infection. And that originates in the marine environment, and that's shown to occur as a result of these viruses being blown inland for over 100 miles. So inland penetration of marine radioactivity may well follow a similar pattern and blow inland to that kind of degree. Now, we know that cesium and tritiated water both mix very well with seawater. So when sea spray blows inland and marine aerosol droplets blow inland, you can expect that to go much for at least 10 miles. That's been proved, and much further than that in light of what happens with some of the other things that I've just talked about, but which the nuclear industry and pro-nuclear governments don't want to investigate and have never bothered to try to investigate in terms of radioactivity. So that's one set of issues. Secondly, that this whole issue of monitoring only the sand, as we have seen in the IAEA video, what you really need to be doing is monitoring fine sediments, which you can find on deep seabeds, and you can find it in estuaries. And the fine sediments in deep seabeds can be mobilized by storm events and big wave events like cyclones and hurricanes. Plenty of tropical cyclones blow in across the Pacific onto the Pacific coast of Honshu Island and around the Fukushima area. There are estuaries to the north and the south where fine sediments occur. There's a place called Miyagi Bay, which is to the north, which is within striking distance if the winds would happen to be blowing in the right direction of Fukushima discharges. Now, Miyagi Bay has quite a lot of aquaculture and seafood production there, and also people working very closely with the marine environment there. So those people are at risk. Furthermore, the main stream of the Oshio current runs from north to south, from Fukushima area down the coast of Honshu towards the southern end of that island. And all the coastal populations along that stretch of coast to the south of Fukushima are going to have that Oshio current laden with Fukushima radioactivity drifting past their beaches and their coastlines. And there will be fishermen down there who will be working. So it's important to monitor at distance, as well as to monitor for sea to land transfer, as well as to monitor fine sediments in estuaries and on the seabed. Because, as I say, monitoring sand doesn't really give you the worst possible scenario. And we're not looking for the best possible scenario, such as you might find with monitoring sand. We are, the important stuff to search for is the worst case scenario and the impact it may have on people working and or living in an area adjacent to those worst case geographical situations. So there's a lot that can be done, but it isn't being done. Partly it isn't being done because it's cheaper not to do it. Say the monitoring of alpha, like plutoniums and the americium, for instance, monitoring for tritium and organically bound tritium is much more expensive than monitoring for cesium. So I expect that what we'll see and the end results of all this monitoring is a lot of gamma radioactivity results for cesium, substances like that. Less beta emitting results, because that's more expensive than gamma analysis, and probably virtually nil alpha analysis, because that is the most expensive one to monitor. So, you know, what they need to be doing is to put a much larger workforce up and down the coast at considerable distance. Because, I mean, in the UK, we have found that radioactivity from Sellafield, for instance, has been found blowing inland on an island 200 kilometres away from the Sellafield site. And there, the amount of radioactivity coming ashore, this is cesium-137, coming ashore has been shown to be higher than is actually found in the area of the actual discharge, because it reconcentrates. It gets into the sediment, it gets into marine bacteria and microorganisms, and work done on the Sellafield coast, for instance, has shown that microorganisms blowing ashore carry much more radioactivity than the water or the fine particle sediments, which are also blown ashore. So it's just a very, very complicated scenario if you want to get the precise and accurate definition of how much radioactivity there is in the marine environment, in the seawater and the sediment. And if you're going to look at biology, it's important to look at the climax predators. So we might think that, say, climax predators would be some of the seabirds who are eating fish all the time. We might think that the climax predators would be coastal populations who are eating seaweed and seafoods. And to date, I haven't seen any monitoring of, I've seen monitoring of seaweed, but I haven't seen any monitoring of shellfish being referenced. And I haven't seen any monitoring of climax predators like, say, swordfish or tuna, or perhaps some of the cetaceans that some Japanese communities are still eating. And those would be things that would have much higher levels than ordinary fin fish. So the work could be done. We have the technology to do the work, but I think it's all about money and the fear of the excess cost. And it's about, we don't want to scare the public by looking for the worst case scenarios. So just let's just do stuff that's going to provide reassuring results. And I really do think that the nuclear industry is cynical enough to be thinking that and acting upon those thoughts.
Tim, it's always an education to listen to you. You always deliver about 5 to 10 times more information than I expect will be forthcoming. And we will stay in touch with you regarding the release of radioactive tritium-contaminated water into the Pacific Ocean by Japan and Tokyo Electric Power Company. And until we meet again, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Levy. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and share any information that I can find. Thank you.
Tim Deer Jones. He is a UK-based marine biologist, researcher, and consultant who specializes in analysis of the radiation threats to our planet's waters from a wide range of nuclear sources. And we are posting that video that was put together by the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, to show what a great job they're doing. It's all very telegenic. You'll see that it's slickly done, reassuring, but in truth, it gives us nothing in terms of hard information. That video is up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 646.
Activists, shout out, shout out, shout out.
We have a second interview for you. It's with Tanya Moss, Dr. Tanya Moss. She is director of the Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio, which holds the largest archive of materials in the United States related to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings and the Hibakusha, the survivors. This archive is second only to the Hiroshima Peace Institute in Japan in terms of its all-encompassing reach and the quality of its materials. Tanya holds a PhD in modern Japanese history from the University of Chicago, and over the past decade, she has taught numerous history courses on the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as well as Japanese imperialism in East Asia. She has served as director of the Peace Resource Center since January of 2015, where she tends to the care and preservation of its Barbara Reynolds Memorial Archives, making its diverse contents widely accessible to researchers, humanities scholars, journalists, artists, undergraduate and high school students, and the public. Through the Peace Resource Center and its archives, Dr. Moss seeks to expand the local, regional, national, and international awareness of the experience and danger of nuclear war. We spoke on October 27, 2023. Tanya Moss, thanks so much for joining us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks so much for having me.
First of all, what is the Peace Resource Center and what is your position there?
The Peace Resource Center houses the Barbara Reynolds Memorial Archives, and it is the largest collection of materials in regard to the human experience of nuclear war vis-a-vis the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the United States. And we're the only academic center in the United States wholly devoted to understanding the human experience of nuclear war through the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I currently serve as the Peace Resource Center's director.
What kind of materials are there in the Peace Resource Center?
Sure. Well, we're primarily an archive. So we have roughly 40,000 to 50,000 historical documents that span the range from early 1940s all the way up to the present. Our collection is largely concentrated in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So it's really thinking about the human experience of nuclear war through atomic bombing survivors, and also through nuclear disarmament activists, primarily nuclear disarmament activists in Japan and the United States. So that sort of makes up the large body of our materials. In addition, we have film footage and audio materials that reflect perspectives and viewpoints of nuclear disarmament activists, atomic bombing sufferers. We have numerous artifacts from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, both from the time of the atomic bombings, but also from the 1950s and 60s and 70s. And so we care for these, we preserve them for the future, and we make them accessible to researchers. We just had a researcher join us from the School of Social Sciences in Paris and spend 2 weeks with us researching materials regarding the French perception of nuclear weapons development in Japan. And so we field researchers all facilitate research all year round.
How is the material accessed and who is available to use it?
Our collection is largely 2D. We do not have the majority of the collection digitized at this point. And so people come to the collection directly. It's accessible to researchers, independent researchers, researchers affiliated with organizations and institutions of higher education, but also facilitate research in our local community from high school students, from students on the Wilmington College campus, and from activist organizations who are seeking to have a better understanding of nuclear disarmament activism. So we have, you know, a wide range of people who utilize the center, and we are happy to consider all research requests.
How are people able to use the materials from the Peace Resource Center to bolster the concept of peace and put it forth in the world when we are up against such negative pro-nuclear forces these days?
So we really appreciate academic scholarship that furthers our understanding of state violence and state use of nuclear weapons as an expression of state violence, because that is something we want to come to an end. So that's critical. And I think this topic remains fascinating because it's the ultimate. One of the students in my class said, the state really is a narcissist. And I said, yes, the state really is a narcissist. And these weapons express that narcissism and that cynicism of the state. All states who hold nuclear weapons and would use them toward their civilians and toward other civilians. So we want people to interrogate that fundamental sort of assumption that states are allowed this kind of narcissism and destructive use of force. But on the other hand, we have welcomed a variety of artists, all the way from dancers to photographers to filmmakers, poets, novelists, painters, photographers have used our materials and created innovative works. A few years ago, I collaborated with a colleague. It was her brainchild, and created the Response Project, in which we solicited 7 artists from across the country, and they responded to a material or artifact in the collection and created a new piece of work, a musical composition, a film, montage, poems. And we found, I continue to use those to express the desire for peace, the human desire to find alternatives to resolving conflict. We know that human conflict happens, and it's part of our interactions because all human beings are different. But if we could spend as much money and resources towards finding nonviolent solutions to conflict at the personal and local, regional, national, and global levels as we put into these huge weapons, we certainly could impact people's lives, create a more peaceful and higher quality of life. So we really like the way that artists take these pieces and make the materials of our archives much more accessible to the public.
If the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat want to learn more about the archive and possibly avail themselves of it, where do they need to go and what do they need to do?
Yeah, so you can go to www.wilmington.edu/PRC, or you can contact me at prc@wilmington.edu. And I would love to hear from people out there. And I would love for them to come visit Wilmington College.
We'll see what we can do on your behalf. Tanya Moss, thanks so much for the interview and for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby.
That was Dr. Tanya Moss, Director of the Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio. We'll have a link up to that website on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 646. The Union of Concerned Scientists has put out a call for calls to be made to the new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, asking him to support the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, which was created to provide partial compensation for those who were harmed by radiation exposure from U.S. government nuclear weapons testing and uranium mining. RECA is an invaluable program for those individuals who are suffering from this radiation exposure, but it is a very flawed act. It does not go far enough financially to support those who were harmed, and it is also set to expire in June of 2024. While the good news is that the Senate recently passed legislation to significantly strengthen RECA, including previously excluded downwind and uranium mining populations and improving benefits. The bad news is that the fight ain't over yet. This extension and expansion of Eureka is part of the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, and word on Capitol Hill is that it could be cut out. So what UCS is asking is that you take action today. Call Speaker Mike Johnson and demand that he support communities exposed to radiation from nuclear weapons activities. UCS has written out suggested talking points, and they will be available from our website. We will have a link. That's under nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 646. The Marshallese Educational Initiative, or MEI, based in Springdale, Arkansas, is planning a multi-day nuclear legacy conference in March of 2024. This will be to bring together nuclear-affected communities and advocates to share their stories about the ongoing consequences of nuclear development and testing. This event will include a commemoration of Nuclear Victims Remembrance Day, an annual event observed by the Marshallese government and people to remember the devastating impact of the United States detonation of the Castle Bravo bomb on March 1st of 1954. Benedict Madison, executive director of MEI, shares, "When the general public turns its attention to nuclear weapons, it is usually in the context of fear of its use during international conflicts and times of war. The Marshallese people have a much different experience. We want to broaden that conversation to inform the public that nuclear weapons production and testing has a devastating and ongoing effect on communities around the world. This conference will gather together affected community members from across the United States and around the globe to share their stories. If you want more, you can contact them at info@mei.ngo. And it's actions like this that have earned Benedict Madison one of three Nuclear Free Future Awards for 2023. Those awards will be given out at a ceremony in New York City on Tuesday, November 28. A new venue, the Blue Gallery, which is located at 222 East 46th Street in New York. This is just a bit over half a mile away from the United Nations building, which is where the states' parties on the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons will be meeting that entire week. So a strong presence of international activists and government representatives is expected there. The evening begins with a 5:30 reception, followed by the awards ceremony. And the winners are all campaigners seeking justice for victims of atomic testing. In addition to Benedict Madison of the Marshall Islands, awards will also be given to Hanamura Morgant Cross of French Polynesia and Tina Cordova, founder and fierce fighter on behalf of the Tularosa Basin downwinders and indeed all downwinders of the Trinity atomic bomb test in New Mexico. The late Daniel Ellsberg will also be honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award presented by Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman. It's free, it's fun, it's an international in-gathering of people who dedicate their lives to fighting against nuclear and for people and the environment. I think you'd fit right in. I know I will, and I plan to be there, and I hope to see you. Be sure to say hi. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 24th, 2023. If you're tired of missing episodes of Nuclear Hot Seat and want to make certain that you have each week's edition, it's real easy to do. When you go to nuclearhotseat.com, there will be a big honking yellow box that pops up. And if you put your first name and an email address into that box, every week you will get one, count them, one email from me, which will include a link to that week's show and a brief summary of some of the material that's inside it. Easiest way you can go. Second best, if you do a lot of podcasts, sign up on your podcast channel because we are everywhere. And if there is a community radio station in your area, you know, one of those that have low power, but they're in a concentrated area, so at least they've got some reach, and it's run by volunteers, and it's all nonprofit. If you've got one of those, Nuclear Hot Seat is available to them at no charge to be carried every week. We send it out through the Pacifica AudioPort Network. So if you've got one of those in the neighborhood, let them know about us, let us know about them, and let's see if we can cook something up and get the show on. We're already broadcast in more than 20 markets around the country, and we would like that number to grow exponentially. So if you can help us out with that, we will really appreciate it. And one other thing you can help us out with. You're right there on the ground with your nuclear story. So you know that it exists and you know things about it that I probably don't. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, it's always an option. If you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help, and anything at all, we will be extremely grateful to receive. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023. Libby Halevi, Hardestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the source, meaning the show, the website URL, my name, and the names of any guests whose comments you use. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as Stanford professor and environmentalist Mark Z. Jacobson posted on Twitter just last week, as of October 29, it has been 34 days straight that a subsidized Diablo Canyon nuclear reactor in Northern California has been down. In fact, 18.5% of all nuclear reactors in the U.S. are down right now, meaning as of October 29th. So much for reliable baseload energy. There you have it. You've just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So, hey, whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
What have those boys been drinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.